The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Model and TV star Jenny McCarthy is known for her bombshell looks, vibrant personality, but lately she's more likely to be associated with her public statements as part of the anti-vaxxer movement. Her belief in a link between vaccines and autism, a link that's thoroughly been debunked by science, is just one example of anti-science rhetoric that was condemned in a recent essay by journalist Chris Mooney called "This Is Why You Have No Business Challenging Scientific Experts." John Horgan writes the Crosscheck blog for Scientific American, and he's here to offer a counterargument that everybody has the right to challenge the experts. And John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here.
So just to be clear, when you say everybody, you really mean everybody. You're talking about climate change skeptics, anti-GMO groups, the Jenny McCarthys, the Rob Schneiders, everybody, right?
Yeah. I just want to say that my article really wasn't a defense of Jenny McCarthy specifically, vaccine deniers, deniers of global warming, people like that.
Right.
I am concerned about those populations as well because they are raising what I think are irrational objections to science. But a larger problem for me is that some scientists and science journalists have circled the wagons and have put out this idea that only, not just scientists in general, but only scientific experts in a very specific field are really qualified to talk about that field. And what's bizarre about that argument for me, especially coming from another journalist like Chris Mooney, is that it undercuts the authority of us science journalists as well to challenge scientists. And it seems to me that that is our job, it's our responsibility as journalists to challenge what the scientific authorities are telling us about certain areas.
Well, that makes me think, what purpose do you think that non-experts play, whether it's a science journalist or, just some very interested person, what role do they play when it comes to evaluating scientific research in general?
Well, I think they can play the same role that that journalists themselves do. They can form groups that have an activist role and challenge the consensus in, let's say, treatments for mental illness. And there are certainly lots of groups like that. Or challenge theories that attribute human behavior and mental illnesses to specific genes. There's been a lot of science that supposedly establishes connections between mental disorders like depression and schizophrenia and so forth to specific genes, but actually the science for that is fairly flimsy. I do believe that some people know more than others and are better at assembling evidence and making arguments for a certain theory, but I hate the idea of science becoming some kind of unassailable authority. I'm for a more democratic kind of science where anybody in principle can participate and challenge the status quo.
Part of the issue, too, is this assumption that if nobody can challenge, experts, that means the science community is infallible, that there aren't errors of judgment and that there isn't sometimes ethical lapses as well.
Yes. And there is this emerging body of literature that suggests that not just some scientific claims that are published in peer-reviewed journals are erroneous, but a majority are. There's a statistician at Stanford named John Ioannidis who has published a series of papers over the last 10 years showing how unreliable the scientific literature is. So it's actually peculiar to me that in some ways science is becoming, or certain scientists are becoming, more arrogant and thin-skinned about outside criticism at the same time as there is more and more evidence of the fallibility of science. And it still means that if you want to be a critic of science, you have to know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you got to do the research.
That's right. You have to do the research. But in principle, I think anybody should be able to do that. I was an English major in college and then went to graduate school and started learning about science and ended up becoming a science journalist. But in principle, anybody should be able to look at peer-reviewed articles, even ones that are highly technical, and then maybe read popular books and come to conclusions that might be at cross purposes with what the received wisdom is.
You know, I feel like a lot of the research community's frustrations on this issue has to do with the fact that people like Jenny McCarthy can be just very influential, and perhaps more influential than even the most credible studies that are conducted. And I wonder if you think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, there are legitimate concerns about false balance. So if you have, on the one hand, a guy from the World Health Organization talking about the safety of childhood vaccines and how essential they are for improving the health in third world countries, and then you have Jenny McCarthy to represent the other point of view, that is definitely a problem. But I am actually more worried about mainstream scientists saying things that are exaggerated or simply untrue about certain scientific fields. I just wrote a piece on my blog recently that was inspired or provoked by an essay in the New York Times within the last couple of weeks talking about something called the feel-good gene. So this is a guy at Cornell Weill Medical Center, a professor of psychiatry, an authority in the field of psychiatry, who is telling all the New York Times readers that scientists have identified a gene that makes people less anxious and happier. And this is an astonishing claim to me because I've been following the field of behavioral genetics for decades now, and I'd never heard a claim that of this kind of discovery. So I found the paper that this psychiatrist, his name is Richard Friedman, had been talking about. It was very dense and technical, but I eventually figured out what was going on, and it presented the flimsiest kind of evidence. That this gene had actually been associated in any significant way with reduced anxiety. But unfortunately, many more people are going to be reading that piece in the New York Times and are going to be reading my blog. So there is going to be this impression out there that science is advancing in understanding human mental disorders, and that this can lead, as Richard Friedman claimed, to better drugs for treating anxiety and reducing depression based on this kind of research, when in fact there is really no substance to those claims.
Well, if you share the view then that say the anti-vax movement is a dangerous one, and probably there's other things that we could talk about that would be similar cases, I'm wondering, is there any qualifier that you'd be willing to make about who should and shouldn't be able to question the experts, or under what conditions?
You know, I'm pretty much a free speech absolutist, and so I have this
questioning libertarian,
right? So I have this idea, and it's probably absurdly naive, that there should be this marketplace of ideas, and that in this marketplace, in this great discourse that's happening across the globe and within different communities, good ideas will eventually rise to the top, and bad ideas will sink. Sometimes it's hard to sustain that belief when the forces of irrationality seem to be winning. But I think that going in the other direction and saying that there are only certain people who are qualified to talk about very important topics is anti-democratic. So that's really my attitude.
I think a lot of people are going to be able to understand that. But I have to wonder, we've got a presidential race that's heating up. Senator Ted Cruz has been in the game. He recently compared climate change skeptics like himself to Galileo. And that's, just one thing that has had plenty of scientists and historians a little riled up. I think part of the fear here is that, You know, if you're part of the scientific community and say you're concerned about something like climate change, there's worry that someone like Ted Cruz, who isn't really part of that scientific community, but they could do real damage by ignoring the evidence and then basing policy on that viewpoint.
Right. But I think that the only way, I mean, you're not going to shut up Ted Cruz no matter what. The only way to counter him or to prevent people from believing what he says or for him, prevent him from gaining more traction for his ridiculous views is to argue on the basis of evidence. If we're talking rhetorical strategies, I think it's actually hurting your cause if you just arrogantly denounce some people as idiots and claim that they are, you know, they shouldn't even be listened to, that they should be censored in some way, which of course is impossible. It just takes more argumentation to beat out some of these bad ideas. That's my idea, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, more argumentation is something that we're definitely in favor for here at Word of Mouth. So, John Horgan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Horgan, a science writer and a columnist for Scientific American. You can check out his writing for the Crosscheck blog and more at wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from the contentious issue of challenging scientists to a surprisingly controversial question. How many birds are killed by domestic cats each year? The American Bird Conservancy has created an online scientific survey called Project Predator Watch to determine the number, and they estimate it to be in the hundreds of millions. Cat advocates, on the other hand, insist that figure is grossly exaggerated, and as Michael May reports from Austin, Texas, the debate isn't just among scientists, and it's getting heated on the ground.
Susan Schaffel lives along a winding street in the Austin suburb of Circle C. It's a former hill country ranch that was bulldozed into a patchwork of upscale homes, velvet green lawns, and backyard pools. But Susan's yard stands apart. It flutters with sounds and color. She sits near a gurgling pond surrounded by native trees and a half dozen bird feeders that are currently attracting cardinals.
They stand on that little fountain that keeps my water circulating, and they just stand there and they drink, and I think it's so cool. I call it a bird moment.
But this pastoral scene masks a bloody Darwinian struggle for survival. Susan has unwittingly created a smorgasbord for the fluffiest of predators.
It started with watching my neighbor's cat jump 8 feet up to a fence where I had a bird feeder and kill a blue jay. You know, when you have something that, like that occur in front of you, it's like, uh-huh. And so what I did was I walked out and I followed, and it was really sad. I followed the blood drops, because the bird was bleeding in the cat's mouth, and then the bird was just left on the front door of the owner. For what?
Well, that's what cats do. And Susan's backyard habitat is ironically less native to suburbia than the domestic house cat. But Susan is determined to protect her beloved birds. She sets traps for neighborhood cats and sends them to the local animal shelter. She even caught a cat that she knew belonged to a friend across the street.
I told her that if I caught her cat one more time in my yard, that I would bring it home in a box because I lost my temper.
Susan has caught 18 cats, and they still keep coming by for a bit of blood sport. So she's taken her campaign to City Hall. She's urging city council members to adopt a law that would require cats be kept indoors. And she wants to eradicate or confine the hundreds of thousands of feral cats that live in Austin's alleys and dumpsters. Her dogged activism and harsh tactics have earned her a reputation as a killer among the most powerful animal lobby in Austin, the cat lovers.
They just don't stand a chance. Once they're trapped by her, they are pretty much doomed. And that's a pretty high price, I think, to pay for anything.
Sheila Smith is just as passionate about feral cats as Susan is about wild birds. In the midst of an unusual winter storm that hit Texas this week, Sheila set out across a frozen yard in a rundown neighborhood in the city of Round Rock, just north of Austin. Sheila and a small army of volunteers are caring for a huge colony of feral cats here. They've already neutered 400 of them. We stop at the porch of a musky-smelling abandoned mobile home still full of clothes and furniture. The cats are hiding somewhere warm, but it's clear they've been here to eat.
The cats are fed here every day, and we make sure that there's plenty of kibble for them.
What Sheila is doing is technically illegal. The city of Round Rock has passed the exact law that Susan hopes to pass in Austin. Owners are required to keep their cats on their own property and that includes Sheila's feral cats.
It's almost like a senseless ordinance, because how do you enforce something like that? There's cats outdoors, and there's always going to be cats outdoors.
Indeed. Austin officials say they probably won't try to force cats indoors. But cat and bird lovers have found some common ground. Both sides are backing a law that would force owners to neuter their pets.
I would think there would be options where both the birds and the cats could coexist, you know, just as I would wish that bird advocates and people that are cat advocates could coexist. There's room for both of us.
That story was produced by Michael May. And Word of Mouth continues with a look at a growing trend that's concerning some scientists across the pond, why more and more Europeans are ditching Darwin's theory of evolution in favor of creationism. That story after a break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. While only two states allow creationism to be taught in public schools without restriction, Tennessee and Louisiana, it's easy to think that creationism is a strictly American and a strictly Christian phenomenon. But in reality, the creationist movement is much more nuanced and spreads across the globe. Stefan Blanca is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Philosophy and Moral Science at Ghent University and one of the authors of the new book, Creationism in Europe, which traces its rise across the pond. And Stefan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Now, this is sort of maybe a narcissistic thing to come out of the gate with, but is creationism an American import? You know, like pop music and blue jeans, have we created creationism and now it's spreading to Europe, or is this a separate thing?
Well, it's both, I think. To a large extent, it's American import. But these ideas were important for the United States, but of course they had to find a fertile soil. Yeah, sometimes it connects really well with the traditional beliefs of a particular religious group. For instance, in the Netherlands, you have very strict Reformed churches, Protestant churches, and they already had discussions about the creation of the earth and young earth creationist views in the 1920s and the 1930s. So you see that once these ideas from the United States arrived in the Netherlands, that they were very easily apprehended by these religious groups.
So Scientology has made an effort to recruit members in Europe, and I'm wondering if that might be the same with some of the U.S.-based creationist organizations. Are they actively promoting it abroad?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a chapter in our book by Barbara Forrest that shows that the Discovery Institute makes efforts to introduce intelligent design, for instance, in the United Kingdom. You can also tell that some creationist groups are just European versions of American organizations. There is definitely influence from young earth creationist organizations.
And when you say young earth creationists, you're talking about young earth as in people that believe the earth is young, as in literally 10,000 years old.
Yes. There are several varieties. So it's not just young earth creationism. You also have old earth creationism that more or less accepts the fact that the earth is old, right, as the name implies. And they have several different ways of reconciling that view with what you could call a literal interpretation of Genesis, right? But then you have intelligent design, which is a more abstract view that says that you can find evidence of an intelligent design in nature. So you have very complex mechanisms, functional mechanisms, what we call adaptations. And they argue, well, this is too complex to have evolved by natural selection, and you need to have intelligent designer that put these things together.
Well, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how creationism differs from country to country in Europe. For instance, you know, how is a bump in creationist beliefs in Poland different from a bump in Turkey?
Right. Well, the obvious difference, of course, is that creationism in Poland is Catholic creationism, and whereas in Turkey it's Islamic. And that's also a very interesting thing about creationism in Europe, that you see that you have this, what you might call this core of creationist beliefs, but that it's very easily adapts to its surroundings.
You know, it's interesting. Here in the U.S., a lot of the debate over creationism is whether or not it should be taught in schools. And of course, that reason for that being such a debate is that we have a separation of church and state. And so that starts to get rather complicated. And I wonder how different countries in Europe and different systems in Europe change the way it's being adopted. Is it such a debate in all these European countries as it is here in the U.S.? Is it as contentious?
Well, it's more difficult, I think, for creationists to obtain some kind of political power so that they can influence educational system. Because in the United States, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think education is organized more at the local scale, where school boards have an influence or have a say in which textbooks will be adopted and things like that. Whereas in Europe, it's very concentrated, the power. So if you want to have some influence, you have to get to the government itself. So it's not at the local level. Sometimes they manage to influence the Minister of Education. In the report of the Council of Europe, there are several incidents in which a Minister of Education, of all ministers, makes a suggestion to balance evolutionary theory with creationism. For instance, in the Netherlands, the Minister of Education made such a suggestion, in Italy, in Serbia. And today, the most activism now in that regard is in Scotland, where local groups, creationist groups, are teaching creationism at schools, at certain schools.
Philosophically speaking, I wonder if you have any ideas about why creationism appeals to so many people. And we were wondering specifically, you know, whether or not this is a reaction to the sort of secularism that we, at least in the U.S., think of Europe sometimes as. You know, Sweden, the Netherlands come to mind, very secular. Is this sort of a rejection of that?
It is a response to secularism and the values, the modern values of Western society. When you read the literature, for instance, in the Netherlands, creationists tend to have this very romantic view of society as they dream it was before, for instance, before the 1960s, right? So this very traditional kind of society.
Stefan Blanc, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Okay, thank you.
Stefan Blanke is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Philosophy and Moral Science at Ghent University. He's one of the authors of the new book, Creationism in Europe. You can learn more about it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. From unanswered Facebook messages to commercials at the gas pump to the smartphones vibrating in our pockets, outside forces are constantly vying for our attention. In his new book, The World Beyond Your Head, Matthew Crawford ponders distraction in the 21st century and ways to reclaim our focus. In addition to being an author, Crawford is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, and he's also a motorcycle mechanic at the Reclaimed Vehicle Fabrication Lab. And Matthew Crawford, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems like this is, you know, an argument that we've heard before. First, it was, and this is quite a while ago now, radio is rotting our brains. Then it was TV is rotting our brains. Now people are saying the same sorts of things about social media. Do you think we are more distracted than we have been before?
Well, you're right. It's an old complaint. In fact, it was over 100 years ago that a German sociologist referred to what he called the intensification of nervous stimulation that he associated with the city environment. But yeah, so maybe this has been an ongoing thing, and I tend to think it's actually not so much the technology itself that's the source of this as the intention behind it. One way this really kind of came into focus for me was that when I was in the grocery store and I swiped my bank card to pay for groceries. And so you know how you enter your PIN code and
then
there's a pause and then you confirm the amount. And so there's these little pauses. And during those pauses, I was shown advertisements.
Wow.
Because some genius figured out that a person in that situation is a captive audience. And so it just kind of, I started to see this everywhere that there's this really aggressive effort to monetize our attention. And I think we're not yet very articulate about making a claim for our attention on our own behalf and regarding it as a resource. I guess speaking up for or against the kind of appropriations of our attention that have become pervasive.
Well, you said that it's not that technology is to blame. So what role do you think technology does play, and especially the stuff that people tend to complain about, social media, or smartphones?
Well, part of it is that a lot of this stuff seems to be engineered to tap into sort of mental appetites that are hardwired. So just as food engineers figured out how to create hyper-palatable foods by manipulating levels of salt and fat and sugar, some of these digital media seem to do something similar in that they're tapping into these hardwired appetites. So you might consider distractibility as the mental equivalent of obesity in terms of its kind of widespread societal effect.
You know, I wonder how much, we are sort of to blame. I don't mean to keep throwing around the blame word as though this is what we're trying to do, but I was thinking, you know, it seems that we seek out distraction on some level. You know, I will sometimes do everything in my power to remove distractions when I'm working on a project, and yet I will find some way, you know, whether it's spinning a quarter on the desk in front of me, to keep myself from doing what I'm trying to do sometimes.
I think that's a really important point. It's not just that we have these unwanted intrusions. There's also diversions that we willingly invite into our lives, whether it's Candy Crush on your phone or porn or whatever it might be. And sometimes we find these no less disturbing than the intrusions because they seem to crowd out other forms of engagement with our surroundings and with other people. But as you said, on this front, there seems to be nobody to blame but ourselves. So what you find instead is people reaching for this notions of self-control. And it seems like strategies for self-regulation are having a renaissance right now that's
right.
Kind of unprecedented. It's not something we associate with consumer capitalism. It sounds like somebody, you know, more in a monastery. But I think we're not going to be able to either kind of liberate or self-regulate our way out of mental fragmentation. I think the remedy, rather, is to become absorbed in some worthy object that has intrinsic appeal and that elicits your involvement in such a way that your mental energies are kind of gathered to a point. And once that's underway, I find it feels more like abandon than self-control. I think the language of eroticism is maybe better suited for parsing it than is the language of asceticism.
I'm speaking with Matthew Crawford. He's the author of a new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. And what you're talking about sort of reminds me of this concept of flow, which people have talked about, you know, when you're really into something to the point where everything sort of just fades away. And in your book, you examine the workflow and attention spans of people doing a few different professions. They don't sound connected necessarily. You talk about short order cooks, bartenders, glass blowers. What are they doing right, do you think?
Yeah, so consider a bartender. So he gets an order, let's say it's a house of glass red, a mojito, a martini up, and whatever, a beer. So what does he do? He lays out the different kinds of glasses that each of those different drinks requires on the bar, and announce other orders are coming in at the same time, and he lays out more glasses sort of next to those. And what that means is that both the content of those orders and their sequence is visible at a glance. It's out there in the world, which is good because there's only so much room in his head. So this is just one example of the way that we can recruit our surroundings to sort of scaffold and support our cognitive abilities rather than tax them unnecessarily.
So how do you think that translates to, you know, sort of off-the-job life? I mean, for a lot of these people, the jobs may be rewarding. Sometimes they're not. But those are jobs. And often when I think of distraction, I think of our time away. It's, you know, it's our recreation time that sometimes we're not using to the fullest.
Yeah, I certainly feel like that. So,
because I'm glad you share this pain,
yeah.
At least a little bit.
Absolutely. I don't offer myself as a guru on this stuff. I'm just trying to think through the problem. So one example is, I open a challenging book and I try to read it. And I find that after about a page, I'm drumming my fingers on the table and I'm getting kind of antsy. And then I realize, oh, it's Tuesday night. My favorite TV show is on. And so I turn it on and who knows, maybe this is for the best because the next day I have some basis for chit-chat with other people. I'm not a freak. In grad school, I felt sort of disconnected from the surrounding culture because I was so intensely focused on what I was doing.
Yeah.
And whereas now I like to think I'm kind of hip. But here's the thing. So if I had gotten absorbed in, say, Aristotle last night, my head would still be turning in these spirals of untimely thoughts that would sound strange to my acquaintances. And if my experience is typical, it means that we're becoming more similar to one another. I think there's a large cultural consequence to our ability to concentrate on things that aren't immediately engaging or lack of that ability, and that is the persistence of intellectual diversity. So I think to insist on the importance of trained powers of concentration is to recognize that independence of thought is a fragile thing and requires certain conditions.
So I guess the idea is a lot of the distractions that we face in life are bringing us to some sort of center, to some sort of sameness?
I think so. I think there's a kind of washing out of human difference, because it's in sort of throwing yourself into these demanding practices that aren't immediately engaging that people cultivate their highest powers. Maybe it's practicing the piano. You have to do a lot of mindless repetition of scales to get to the point where you're, you know, expressing yourself on the piano. And the problem is that we're constantly being addressed with these kind of hyper-palatable mental stimuli. So there does seem to be a kind of asceticism that's required to get it off the ground, that is, you're becoming skilled in some demanding practice.
Well, you know, one of the parts of your book you talk about is sort of the visual distraction. There's a lot on ads. You know, it's one thing when it's at your home. What do you do when it's in your face? What do you do when you're out, at the grocery store and you're faced by an ad? What can you do in that situation?
Well, there's not a whole lot. The cognitive psychologists talk about the orienting response, which is so an animal turns its face and eyes toward the new thing, that whatever appears in your visual field. And this is important in a world of predators, right? It's an important evolutionary adaptation.
Sure.
Well, if you're at the airport with the, you know, TV screens everywhere, there's something new about once every second. And speaking of the airport, there was one time I was, you know, the bottoms of those bins that you place your items in for security screening are now papered with ads.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, you haven't noticed
that? I haven't
flown
in a couple of years, so.
So one time, I had a flash memory stick in there that was very important. I had a talk on there I was going to have to give in a few hours. Well, and it's about the size of a lipstick, right?
Yeah.
So the bottom of the bin was papered with an ad for lipstick. So there's all these lipsticks, you know, fanned out, and I very nearly missed my my flash memory thing. And so it just made me think, like, who decided to pimp out the security trades with these ads? Like, public space has been just auctioned off in this way. And let me give you another example. I was at the 30th Street station in Pennsylvania. It's this beautiful old train station. But you could see that it was beautiful only by trying to peer around or through these swimming pool-sized banner ads that were hanging up. All these banner ads were for a single enterprise. Apparently this was called the Station Domination Campaign. So on this occasion, it was for some resort in the Bahamas. And what it felt like is that I was in a place that was no longer really a place. It was a mere surface on which to display enticements to be somewhere else. And it made me think, doesn't Philadelphia have any pride? Because it really did feel like a public patrimony had simply been sold off. And I think this is connected to a wider sense that politics has been captured by narrow interests that are often commercial in nature. And the very idea of the public is somehow at risk.
Well, Matthew Crawford, it was a pleasure and a relief to be able to pay attention to your book and have this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Matthew Crawford, senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. He's also the author of The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. You can learn more about Matthew and see more about his book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a man who shed distraction and reclaimed his attention through music. That story from the podcast Day Job is coming up when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked with philosopher and author Matthew Crawford about living in a world that's filled with distractions. And he said,
we're not going to be able to either liberate or self-regulate our way out of mental fragmentation. I think the remedy, rather, is to become absorbed in some worthy object that has intrinsic appeal.
Well, our next story is about a man who has done exactly that, and it comes to us from Joshua McNichols, host of the podcast Day Job.
There's a little guitar shop in Seattle's Roosevelt neighborhood called The Trading Musician. People bring in their guitars to sell. Oftentimes, the instruments are in pretty bad shape.
This is a 1923 Koa Martin. I put a lot of work into this. It must have been 12 hours at least. Did a neck reset, refret, some crack repair. Pretty much got the works.
Ben Todd takes broken and battered guitars and makes them sing again. Ben likes his trade. He likes being an expert and living in the city and being around lots of people. He hadn't always felt that way. Once, circumstances led Ben to seek out a more isolated lifestyle. He had lost his interest in playing music.
I came from more of a punk rock background. I just kind of burnt out on it.
He moved to the rural Southwest and lived among the ranchers, libertarians, and escapists. He survived by doing odd jobs.
I picked apples, harvested blueberries, made adobe bricks.
When he wasn't working, Ben listened to music. His brother had given him a copy of Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music. That's the record that launched the folk revival of the 1960s. Ben fell in love with the music.
God no sugar baby now. God no honey baby now.
I think when I first got it, I was really blown away by Doc Boggs. It just sounded like he was singing from a void, from a scary place. And there was something about the darkness that he conveyed in his music that I found really inspiring. It was like nothing I had ever heard.
Honey baby now, got no sugar baby now.
Ben also fell in love with a girl. The two of them made a little home deep in the New Mexico wilderness.
From there, you could walk in any direction and you wouldn't see a person all day. You could walk for days.
They lived in a trailer with three dogs. They had no phone, no running water. Out back, they built what they called a lonesome shack with a wood stove. And there, Ben played the banjo and his girlfriend sang.
The lonesomeness of it was that there is nothing beyond the two of us.
The two of them made beautiful music together, but there was no one around to hear it.
Is it possible to just be about another person, like in that kind of isolation, without a community around you? I think it's difficult.
One day, Ben was there by the shack, alone. A neighbor stopped by to tell him to watch out for some armed men on the run from the police. The men had ditched a getaway car and were walking around out here somewhere.
A little while later, I saw a guy walking down the highway with a big gun in his hand. And I was just watching him, and when he got closer to the shack is a little ways off the road. There's a barbed wire fence. He started walking towards the shack, and he climbed through the barbed wire fence. The minute I realized that he was actually approaching me, I jumped into the trailer and just laid down under the bed.
Say no, save and don't let her die.
he got to the door, he knocked, he whistled a couple times. Then the dog started barking. And then I waited for a while, and it was quiet, and got up the nerve to peek out the window, and I saw him walking away. And when he got to the road, the two local police cars pulled up and arrested him.
Ben's mom freaked out and gave him a little pistol, a Derringer. But Ben didn't keep it. He left the shack and went to luthier school to learn how to build and repair guitars. The woman in the shack did not follow him.
If I had a gun, I wouldn't be here. If I had a gun, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't last so long. I'd be long gone. It's in my blood. I'm getting thin. Is this the end? A dose of medicine.
Ben arrived in Seattle in a beat-up van full of luthier tools. He spent his days repairing guitars for the trading musician.
This is a guitar that apparently the neck broke and someone glued on a new neck.
Every day, Ben would take a coffee break at the little cafe next door to his work, Cafe Racer. Sometimes he'd come to Cafe Racer at night to play his music there. The audience there loved his music, and soon his band expanded to three people. Ben performed under the name Lonesome Shack. But Ben wasn't feeling lonesome anymore. One day, Ben was busy at work restoring guitars. Then, Ben heard a commotion outside, in front of Cafe Racer. Gunshots.
I saw the ambulances. I saw them pulling out bodies.
A lone gunman with possible mental problems had gone into the cafe and shot five people there.
And I was just in shock, you know, I knew everyone that was hanging out there because I had just been there.
Only one survived.
All the people that were killed there were good friends. It had a huge impact on me to see so many people come together and mourn. It maybe reinforced that this was a community.
Ben had an album's worth of recordings he'd made at Cafe Racer. He wasn't going to put them out, but after the shooting, he changed his mind.
Drew and Joe, who were both shot, were in attendance, and you can hear Drew on the recording making a ruckus, as he was likely to do.
Thank you.
Back at the trading musician, Ben returned to his work. It provided him a way to rest his mind.
This is a Taisco. This is a lot like the guitar I play.
Ben shows me some of the guitars he's worked on. Cherry red, solid-bodied electric guitars, and honey-colored acoustic guitars from Depression-era Sears catalogs. Ben has worked on most of them, repairing their broken necks and resetting their frets. Down in the showroom, the guitars hang from the ceiling and from the walls, like the arsenal of some twisted militiaman living in the New Mexico wilderness. Loneliness and loss are a war, and we're all going to get drafted, eventually. It's unclear how Ben Todd will fight this war. But if these guitars were guns, Ben Todd would be ready.
That story came to us from Joshua McNichols, host of the podcast Day Job, How Musicians Pay the Rent. You can check out more from that series at dayjobmusic.org.
Take your time, take your time. I'll give you mine, I'll give you mine.
Thanks for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you did miss any of today's show, don't forget you can always catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, give it a rating or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.